Hello, and welcome to the Blockchain.com podcast. My name is Nick Carey, co-founder and vice chairman of Blockchain.com. Here at Blockchain.com, we believe in the potential of blockchain technology to improve the state of the world. While cryptocurrencies can radically transform community access to financial products and services, the core technology of public ledgers can be used to build novel applications underpinned by transparency. In our latest podcast segment, Blockchain for Good, we're unearthing contemporary examples of how blockchain technology is making a real-world difference to people, communities, and charities all around the world. We'll learn more about organizations and projects using crypto and blockchain technology to promote social and economic inclusion and sustainability efforts. Today, we're joined by Feritesh Farrow, founder of Code to Inspire, which is the first coding school for women in Afghanistan, to explore Code to Inspire's approach to economic equality. I'm really excited to visit with Feritesh today. Feritesh, we have a little tradition around here. We need to know and learn, how did you earn your first bit of money, your first dollar, your first euro, whatever it was?
Well, thank you so much for having me. That's an interesting question, because when we moved to Afghanistan in 2002, 1 year after the fall of Taliban in Herat, where is the city in west part of Afghanistan, I had a bit of a decent English language literacy. So there was a huge demand of teachers teaching English. So I became an English instructor in an extracurricular activity course, and I started teaching English in for kids. And that was my first time job, and I got paid in Afghani, which is the currency of Afghanistan. And it was so rewarding to me to see that how a knowledge that I gained can be transferred into some monetary form and can empower me and enable me actually to use my knowledge. So that was a super exciting time to be get paid.
Oh, I love that story. Yeah, it's funny. I started off my career too as a teacher in India, and I taught very basic computer science. We built websites with kids. And also English as well, and creative writing. So we share that in common, which is a cool touch point. All right, so tell us a little bit about this background. You said you moved to Afghanistan in 2002, but you're not from Afghanistan. So talk to us about your story there. I know it's very impressive.
Yes, well, I was born in Iran as an Afghan refugee during the Soviet invasion to Afghanistan. My parents fled the war. I grew up in a big family. We are 8 children. I'm the 5th one. So I always say as the 5th child, I kind of like grew up very independent.
Child syndrome. Yeah,
exactly. So I guess being born as a refugee with the challenges and discriminations that you face just because of your indifferences really taught me that how I can be resourceful and, you know, be more agile in an environment that might be challenging. And in such a young age, I learned that great things can start with empty hands. Looking at my mom and how she learned how to stitch and make dresses, and by earning income and bringing money to the family and investing on the children education was very empowering to me, and I learned that lesson. And of course, being a refugee and, you know, discriminated to access to certain financial institutions such as bank, opening a bank account, or even go to school was very disheartening to see that you will be discriminated in this way. As I said, we moved to Afghanistan in 2002, 1 year after the fall of Taliban, and there I got my bachelor in computer science in Herat University, and then I received a scholarship. I went to Germany, and I got my master's in computer science in Technical University of Berlin. I went back to Afghanistan and taught as a computer science professor for about 3 years in the university, and then it was late 2012 that I came to the U.S., and since then I've been staying in the U.S.
Amazing. Thank you for sharing that story. It's really cool to hear about. Okay, so you make it to the United States. Tell us about the origin of Code to Inspire, the organization that you have founded.
you know, kind of what was the origin story of that?
Yes, so it's really, I think, motivated me and inspired me just because of my personal life story. Again, being born as a refugee and deny accessing education in certain, you know, services within the country. And then being a woman studying computer science in Afghanistan, not only in such a male-dominated field of study, but also in a very traditional male-dominated culture. I was a very vocal and outspoken person. And sadly, for that reason, I faced a lot of backlashes, threats, and, you know, verbal sexual harassments, not only within the educational sector, but also in the work sector. And I think that really was for me a reason to think how I can change the situation in a way that the girls and women access a very safe and secure environment to study tech, but also how we can pave the path for them to find jobs. So, and I think that was the reason that I established Code to Inspire as the first computer coding school for girls and women in Afghanistan, November 2015. So we really want to address this perennial economic, cultural, and patriarchal challenges, you know, that women in Afghanistan are facing by providing this safe environment as a one-year after-school program. We teach different coding classes such as web development, full stack, cryptocurrency, blockchain, game design, mobile, and then graphic design. And by teaching that, we want to convert that into, you know, some sort of economic empowerment for these girls, but also bridge the gap in education sector and also wage gap in Afghanistan for women. So far we've educated more than 350 girls in our coding and graphic design classes.
Wow.
And with, of course, before the Taliban taking over Afghanistan in August 2021, with the data we collect from our graduates and alumni, 60% of them found job in Afghanistan with what they've learned from the school. In fact, some of them are getting paid above average monthly income salary in Afghanistan, which is a $150. So some of them actually are making double or triple than the men in the family on and are the sole breadwinner. And we've outsourced about 50 projects worth of $60,000 to the girls that did graphic design work, coding work. And again, 100% of that money went to the girls' pocket.
That's an extremely impressive story, and you're a very impressive person, and thank you for sharing all of that. Let's talk a little bit about how you do this teaching and how it's changed a little bit. Are the courses taught in person? Do you do them digitally? How is the curriculum kind of taught?
Yes. So originally, the program is a one-year after-school program in person. We do have a location in Herat. So before August 21, with the Taliban taking over, we had the school open 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. The girls would come in different schedules and participate in their classes. We have mentors that are teaching the girls in person, of course, in Farsi, but all the materials are in English. Sadly, with the Taliban taking over, we had to close the school. For the 3 months, we really focused a lot of our operation into humanitarian, but then we restarted our school virtually. We picked Google Classroom as the medium, and we uploaded a lot of materials there. We took a survey from our students and see who is still in Afghanistan. Majority of our students didn't have laptops or internet to get into virtual class. So what we did, we distributed laptops to each girl's home. We purchased monthly internet packages for them. And with that being said, we were able to bring 80% of our students back track to school. In fact, last February, we learned that the Taliban de facto administration said that if any local NGO on the ground wants to reopen their operation, they have to renew their work permit. So we actually applied for work permit renewal And after challenging 5 months, we received the work permit, and we were able to reopen the school actually after 1 year closing the school. We immediately announced for new classes for graphic design and coding, and 400 applicants registered for those classes. Wow. We took entrance exam and we accepted top 300 of them. And then they came to school. They were very happy because the school was open, the girls were coming. But sadly, last December, with the Taliban announcement of total ban on education for girls and women, go to university, public, private, and extracurricular activities, and even working, we had to close the school again. But because we had experience with Google Classroom and virtual, we immediately shifted and adapted. And since then, our classes are virtual with 90% participation of our students in all the classes.
Boy, that is an incredible story. Yeah, we keep hearing and reading the news about the bans on education, and it sounds like the way you and your team have been able to pivot and navigate that is extraordinary. Talk to us a little bit about your partnership with Google Class. So we've got laptops for the girls in country, and then they get internet packages, and then you upload curriculums to the Google Class program.
Yes. Well, we picked Google Classroom just because it was an easier medium to be implemented, and there was a huge community support behind it. And of course, with the bandwidth and the internet connectivity, which is a big issue in Afghanistan, not everyone has access to internet, having online and virtual classes would be very challenging. So at the time, we picked Google Classroom as that. However, moving forward, we're thinking about what kind of a medium we can use that can at least function in an environment that has either low bandwidth or no internet connectivity, and the curriculum and content can be accessible offline as well.
Right. Okay, that makes sense. So we've been working in graphic design and coding and website building, financial literacy, and some crypto too. Talk to us a little bit about how your organization has historically and in the future is thinking about just sort of Web3 technologies, but also crypto as a payment mechanism, as a way for women to control access to funds, sometimes in environments where it may be, their family members may try and confiscate money from them, or obviously they're, the more patriarchal systems in place. So talk to us a bit about that.
Well, the history of, me learning about crypto and in particular Bitcoin comes to the late 2013. So when I learned about crypto at the time, it was very fascinating to me just for the fact that as a refugee born, I was denied to access financial resources such as opening a bank account. And it was a pushback because I would be excluded from the financial ecosystem. And that was a hurdle and a challenge for refugees. And when I learned about cryptocurrency, I was, very fascinated because I thought that, wow, this a medium does not discriminate you because of your indifferences and because of the place you were born. And it gives you this financial freedom and also fill this gap, I think, of financial and economic divide that traditional financial institutions perhaps are lacking and are not able to overcome that. And when I was working at the time with the girls in Afghanistan and we had to send them payments using banks or, let's say, Western Union, was certainly not only a time consuming, but also it cost us a lot of fee for transactions, and it required a lot of documentations, and that was very challenging. And I was looking for a way that can help us to do it in a much more efficient way, but also in a more private, secure way. And I think the faster transactions and the lower transaction fees that the cryptocurrency involved was very eye-opening to me, to see that how we can still empower people without going through traditional banking system, especially when we talk about cross-border transactions, which the money can face delays, and even rewired back. was mind-blowing to me. And then even with the fee for transactions, we had to pay, you know, for the bank's fee and Western Union. And that, let's say, $5 to $10 fee you pay, it's a huge money for a family in Afghanistan that can feed the family for, you know, a week. So you want to prevent that. And the global, I think, accessibility of it, you know, no matter of, regardless of your location, either you're in an underserved region or if you are in a conflict zone with an unstable financial system, you still can be a part of this global economy and thrive. You still can access to this financial ecosystem. And especially when we talk about the girls and women in Afghanistan, or even displaced people, you know, in war-torn, that they leave the country without any documentations, or they leave their legal documentation behind. And oftentimes the banks require that. It would be very challenging for them. And also privacy and security aspects of it. So, you know, as a woman living in Afghanistan, especially right now with the Taliban having control over, you know, banks and financial systems, or even limited financial services, you really want to be in charge of your own finances. Because if anything happens and you have to leave the country, you want to take your finances with yourself wherever you go, and you have a custody over it. And I think that's very empowering. And of course, I think the aspects of, you know, the secure transactions, the cryptographic feature of it, and as a woman, thinking that your personal information won't be compromised and be in the hand of, you know, a dictatorship regime, it's such a liberating tool for them as well. So I think these were initially some of the reasons that really inspired me to think about how we can use crypto as a medium to send payment to Afghanistan, but also as an organization to receive crypto as donation.
It's such an incredible example of the importance of the technology and its features. You know, basically a global payment system that enables anybody, regardless of the circumstances of their birth, to be able to do things like send, receive, secure, and exchange value and wealth over distance and time. And thank you for walking us through that. I mean, I think the arguments you make are so, so important. I mean, refugees globally have no access typically to any form of a financial service from a bank or a merchant processor or anything like that. And frequently the turning to open technologies like crypto and in the early days, especially Bitcoin, it's pretty clear that that's, you know, been able to make a meaningful change in people's lives. And, you know, when displaced people have to leave a system of oppression, it's almost impossible for them to take their wealth with them. It'll just be confiscated. And so having economic sovereignty in a toolkit that enables you to bring that with you is so critical. So that's we've been hearing and learning even more about this in the contemporary case of also Ukraine, where there was a lot of money that was raised quickly to help support the humanitarian crisis there as well. Another example of how crypto can respond very quickly to destabilizing political situations. So let's talk a little bit about the future. So Firtash, what's on the roadmap for 2023 in Code to Inspire? You know, what are some things you need help with and how can the listeners today learn more and even donate to Code to Inspire to help you support, you know, youthful technical education of women in Afghanistan?
Yes, well, however, the roadmap for the next year or so seems very challenging and unpredictable, just the fact that we are operating in such a volatile environment that you won't be able to really think about longer term goals. But for us, really, I think it's, I can say we are in a survival mode and we try our best to like take one step at a time. But in general, I think as an organization, you know, we've received a lot of emails, calls, messages from girls around Afghanistan and also personally myself, that they keep asking that can they be part of this program and access our classes and curriculum. But however, we are limited with the resources that we have. So we can only offer very limited access to the cohort that we only have in Herat. But with that being said, because of the urgency and the need, and of course, the, this dire situation on the ground with the girls' limited access, we want to create a bigger platform that has two components, what would be education and the other job placement. And with the education component, it would be a self-paced platform with a lot of different curriculum that the girls can study. And it will be in Farsi, Pashto, and English languages so that we make it more accessible for the girls who don't speak English or learn English. And then with the job placement, we'll recognize and identify the girls on the ground that have education degree, work background, but they're not able to work in Afghanistan. So how we can connect them with the global, you know, workforce outside of Afghanistan, and they can do it remotely. So our goal is to launch this platform early next year. And then in order to be able to expand and scale the entire operation in Afghanistan, in major cities such as Kabul, Mazar, and any other city, and really double and triple our impact. So we really hope to reach out at least to 400, 500 girls next year in order to help them with education. But also, for us, we want to also expand our operation outside of Afghanistan in neighboring countries that a lot of Afghan families fled. But unfortunately, they don't have a clear pathway of immigration and they don't know what will happen to them. It certainly a multi-year, you know, time for immigration. So we want to help the girls in neighboring countries like Pakistan, Iran, Turkey, refugee camps, and support them with online education as well. So that's kind of like the roadmap for us moving forward. We are certainly looking for help and support because we are in such a state that there is an urgency, but there is an expansion. So anyone who has the skills, expertise, that thing that they can bring, help, we are happy to talk to them. We're open to accept new board and, you know, interns, volunteers, but also in case of a donation, if you check our website, code2inspire.org, we accept donations in credit card, PayPal, and then, of course, cryptocurrency. We accept different form of cryptocurrencies as well. And that's how you can support us. And one more thing, one of the most important thing is that if you have any job for our graduates and students, coding, graphic design, please do reach out. That would be a life-changing opportunity that you're giving to these girls on the ground, not only in case of them earning income, but also you're providing and giving them hope so that they can continue to thrive in such a fragile environment.
Well, Faritesh, your resilience is so impressive, and you're an incredible role model, an inspiration for people around the world. So thank you so much for teaching us about Code to Inspire. So code2inspire.org, it's a 501c3 charitable organization. You can donate crypto, you can donate via credit card or PayPal and help fund this extremely important work. You can also be very helpful if you're out there and you need coders or graphic designers, please get in touch with Faritesh's team. And it looks like you also have an open job for a grant writer as well. So anyone who's listening can also go visit code2inspire.org and apply for that to help Faritesh and her team as they expand their important work over the course of the next couple of years. So thank you so much for joining us today. And we are deeply appreciative of your time. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Blockchain.com podcast. If you enjoyed the episode, please like and subscribe to the show. And if your friends and family are embarking on their crypto journey, why not share this episode with them? If you haven't already, visit Blockchain.com to sign up for a free crypto wallet today. We've been around since 2011, and we're the world's most popular way to buy, sell, and trade crypto. See you next time.